Good evening, and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content related to the queer community. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and tonight I'm joined in the studio by activist, educator, and writer Krishna Patisipu. In 2014, Krishna received her PhD in communication studies with a focus on culture, race, and education. And she brings this critical stance to her work in a variety of contexts, from sitting on the Out Boulder County's board of directors to her current role as director of diversity, recruitment, and retention at CU Boulder School of Education. Krishna was recently highlighted on KGNU for a blog post she wrote in response to the acts of violence and white supremacy in Charlottesville, entitled, "Now, More Than Ever, Queer and Trans People of Color Need More Than White Allies." Well, Krishna, thank you so much for joining the show tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean.
Well, could you start just by introducing yourself a little bit more for our listeners, and in particular, touch on how you came to be in your current role in the School of Education at CU?
Absolutely. So I am originally from Southern Illinois, and I am a first-generation college student. So when I was an undergraduate, I got involved with a federally funded program called the McNair Scholars Program, whose aim is to help promote students from underrepresented groups in attaining their PhDs. And that pursuit led me to the University of Denver, where I completed my PhD work and started doing community organizing and activism.
And so in terms of your role at CU, what have you learned in bridging kind of the academic and then the practical kind of on the ground work that you've been doing?
Sure. And thank you for asking that, because this is a question and a conundrum I try to center in all the work that I do. So as a first generation student, I was able to access these higher and higher echelons of academia through attaining more and more advanced degrees. And in that pursuit became pretty, I would say, detached from the issues that are at the root of inaccessibility of higher education. So the higher I went, the fewer people from backgrounds like mine I saw. And by that, I mean people of color, people from rural environments, queer individuals, low-income folks. And so as I was able to access these new sites, I really felt the need to make sure I was reconnecting to the reason that I wanted to be involved with this work at all. And so even though my initial aspiration was to follow the tenure track path and become a professor, I, before graduating, realized that I needed to return to my community and make sure that I, as I had the privilege, as I earned the privilege to access these spaces, I was always speaking with and not for the communities that I come from. And so for me, centering that question of how am I practicing and putting into practice the academic theories and knowledge that I have had the privilege of attaining, to how am I operationalizing that to benefit communities of color, queer and trans communities. That's something that I make sure to center in everything that I do.
Yeah, and that idea of centering voices, action, agency of marginalized communities and individuals, and in particular, queer and trans people of color, that's something you really called out in your recent blog post through Out Boulder County, but also in KGNU. You talked about your role there as a board member really as transformational. Could you say a little bit more about that? What it means to be transformational when we're talking about issues of marginalized communities and simultaneously nonprofits, as Boulder County and many other nonprofits in the area, I'm sure, struggle with this issue or don't yet know they need to struggle with this issue.
Absolutely. So I would say that my quest for community with other queer and trans people of color, or QDPOCs, as we often like to call ourselves, has been a lifelong pursuit of mine. And only recently, I would say within the past 5 to 7 years, have I really been able to start to access other folks who identify as QDPOC. And so I joined the board at El Boulder County, not as a means of finding community, because I joined it as a means of trying to address the community I didn't see there. So I've been working and living in the Boulder area for about 3 years, and coming from the Denver context, where I had more access to community with people of color in general, but more specifically queer and trans people of color, I noticed a huge dearth of that, or a dearth of that here in the Boulder area. And so I looked to who I see to be the leader in the queer and trans liberation movement up here in the Boulder County area, which is out Boulder County. And I really said that, I said to myself, I want to leverage the privilege that I have gained through the credentials that I have to try and carve out spaces like that for other QDPOC folks in this organization.
How might folks working in the nonprofit sector, and if we're thinking about, you know, potential takeaways, or you often call out tools of, for example, critical communication in your, you know, research or academic work, what might those tools look like in the nonprofit setting or sector that folks could take back with them?
I think the most important tool, if we can call it a tool, but maybe more of a strategy, is just making sure that we always center the voices of the most marginalized folks within our communities, right? So when I think about the LGBTQ community, I think about making sure that we always strive to center the voices of trans women of color who have led our movement from the very beginning, but receive very little recognition for that. And so making sure that in the leadership of our organizations, in the programming that we offer, in the approaches that we take to engaging community, we're always making sure that we listen to the knowledge that we have inherited from these strong trans women of color, and making sure that they run our organizations and that their voices are at the center. Unfortunately, we know that nonprofit leadership in the U.S. context does not necessarily follow this model. Oftentimes, nonprofits that serve people of color, often run by people who identify as white, wealthy, educated. And so oftentimes the decisions that are being made for the most vulnerable populations are being made by those who have no firsthand experience with that marginalization. And so that change, because it's not already in effect, will take some time to happen, but it's something that I think we must always strive for, to bring those voices to the center. And that, to me, is the most important strategy in attaining liberation. You know, I see something circulating on social media a lot that if your activism is inaccessible to the poor, it is neither radical nor revolutionary. And so I always think about, you know, I might feel good about what I'm doing, but if I'm ultimately not impacting the folks who are at the most risk or the most vulnerable, then it's not effective. It's not meaningful in the ways that we need for it to be.
Yeah, and this question of voice is such a critical one, because it seems as though when organizations are looking for a silver bullet, quote unquote, to address inclusion or anti-oppression work, that might mean a quote in a brochure from, you know, someone who represents a diverse perspective, or, you know, maybe at an entry level position, you know, an almost tokenization of diverse representation. But what you're talking about really is a longer term view of voice that is really integrated throughout and at all levels of the organization.
And that's really where I see the work that I'm doing with access to education coming in this long term journey or goal, right? So the more people that we can, the more young folks that we can help to access institutions of higher education, who can earn the credentials that society deems necessary to work in these types of industries or organizations, even though embodied and lived experience, I believe, is just as important, if not more so, in leading these types of resistances. But helping them to access bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and then be able to take up the types of leadership roles that oftentimes only white wealthy people have access to, I think that is ultimately how we transform the structure of nonprofit institutions to serve the needs of the most vulnerable folks. And I think that as the daughter of an immigrant, I grew up, you know, learning that having ingrained in me that education is the key to access any type of change. And obviously, I see that it's a little bit more layered in that sense, that even with education, there are very real material barriers and societal barriers to success, that the playing field is never truly leveled. However, I think that in leveraging the privilege that we have, those of us who have been able to access these elite white institutions to then share that knowledge with folks and help lift each other up, I think it is ultimately what will change it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and I'm talking with Krishna Patisipu, an activist, scholar, and writer who currently works on issues of diversity at the School of Education at CU Boulder. I'm curious, as you're working with students today, what connections do you draw to that younger self that was in Southern Illinois, that as a queer person of color growing up with not a lot of access, perhaps, you know, not a lot of connection to community? Do you see any parallels there, or how does that experience inform the way you interact with youth today or with students today?
Absolutely. And I think, to answer that question, I think about the first time I ever had a woman of color as a teacher. And that is such a transformative moment for me in being able to see myself represented in the profession that I'd always dreamed of having. And that goes back to the age-old question of representation, right? And I had never seen myself represented in that type of role before. So when I think about the relationship I had with her, I think about ultimately students potentially seeing that type of person in me and the all the warm and fuzzy feelings that come with that, but then also the deep sense of responsibility. And I am still connected with the first professor that I ever had, a woman of color, and she's continued to be one of my biggest supports throughout my life. And I strive to have even a sliver of that effect on the students that I work with today.
You know, something you're sort of seems like you're talking around is this question of mentorship, and that's something that your research has focused on mm-hmm. in the past. And not just talking about mentorship from people that students can see themselves in terms of facets of their identity, mm-hmm. But also mentorship from intentional coalition building or alliances mm-hmm. with people in positions of privilege or with privileged identities. Mm-hmm. How does that inform your work, that kind of research? How do you see yourself bringing that into the mentorship that you now serve mm-hmm. for others?
Absolutely. So thinking about my academic identity in this capacity is where a lot of my thinking about mentorship started. And I started thinking about this a lot with the folks that I was really privileged to work with as a graduate student. So I had a professor, my advisor at University of Denver, Dr. Bernadette Colifel, who wrote a lot about the power of mentoring relationships between people of color in the academy. So people of color who have been able to access these credentials, sharing that embodied knowledge with the folks that they have the opportunity to advise, but then also having that not be a one-way street or one-way relationship, but being able to talk with one another about the violence that predominantly white institutions inflict upon people from underrepresented backgrounds who are navigating them. So that kind of speaks to the inter-identity piece, right? Women of color supporting each other, healing each other, helping each other access what they hope to access. But then I also think about strategic alliances across identities and how that has been such a huge part of my life. So I was so lucky as a young McNair scholar, undergraduate, learning how to do research, to work with Professor John Warren at Southern Illinois University, who was a white man and helped me to figure out how and when he was able to stand up for me and speak up for me in spaces where my voice was maybe already delegitimized, or in ways that he could leverage his privilege to help me access things as someone that he was mentoring. And together with these two folks, I really came to this idea that we need multiple members of our academic family to help us navigate these structures, right? People that we can share an experience of racism or sexism with, and who automatically understand that, can help us heal around that. And then somebody else who maybe can't understand that on a personal level, but has the racial privilege or the gender-based privilege to be part of conversations we're not often invited into, and help change that from the outside. And one of my favorite scholars, Linda Alcoff, wrote an amazing article in 1991 about the politics of speaking for others. And so making sure that in our activist work, we're never speaking for others who have less privilege than we do, or less representation than we do, but making sure that we're always in dialogue with and speaking alongside those that we hope to build up.
I would imagine that our listeners are drawing connections to, from what you're talking about with mentorship, to a discussion about accomplices or allies in social justice or anti-oppression work generally, and the way in which, you know, we can kind of uncover these dynamics of power imbalances, or working for mm-hmm. versus the working with. Mm-hmm. Do you encounter that a lot when you get questions about allyship, or even, you know, just in your process of thinking through the blog post that you wrote on allyship for queer and trans people of color?
Absolutely, I do. And I think about alliances are, to me, central to alliances across difference to me are essential to any form of long-term sustainable social resistance, because whether or not we like it, people who have privileged identities in society are the ones who right now have access to power, right? Power and privilege go hand in hand. So we need folks who have privileged identities to truly have our best interests at heart. I'm not saying that we need them for our liberation, right? Or that our liberation is tied to their willingness to fight for us, because heaven knows that people of color and queer folks, if we waited for people in privileged positions to fight for us, we would have gotten nowhere. We've gotten ourselves where we are. But I believe that we work together best if we can make sure that people who have privilege, who are willing to leverage it for us, if we make sure that we work hard to sustain those. So, for instance, I place this in a really personal context. So I identify as a person of color. I move through the world as a person of color, but my mother is white. And throughout my entire life, my mother didn't understand from a personal perspective the racism or the homophobia that I experienced. She's a straight white woman, but I've seen her in multiple ways throughout my life stand up for me and utilize her power in the spaces that only she's able to access to speak up for me and to challenge the perspectives of people who I would feel too endangered to challenge on my own. And so in alliance with her, we've been able to accomplish so much more than if I were on my own. Again, not saying that I need her, but it's so much better when I have her. And so I think when I think about alliances, I think about it in that way, that we don't necessarily, people of color don't need white folks, but it's so much better if we can count on our white allies to leverage their privilege.
I think you bring up such an important fold to this conversation about ally or accomplices, this feeling or need for white allies to be involved mm-hmm. in liberation of marginalized communities mm-hmm. or to feel put off by the statement that we don't need you to be involved in our mm-hmm. liberation, and that, you know, perhaps there's no way you can be that wouldn't be harmful if that's your main goal, is mm-hmm. needing to be involved in that liberation. But mm-hmm. you know, separating that and thinking about alliances and the way in which goals may be aligned mm-hmm. if not co-opted or mm-hmm. stolen.
Absolutely. And I think oftentimes people criticize people of color or QDPOC folks for needing what we would call a closed space, right? A space in which white folks or straight folks or and many times people like me, cisgender folks, aren't invited into those spaces. And oftentimes that's seen as a, oh, you're not, this is not conducive to building an alliance. You're the one that's impeding the formation of this alliance. But what allies might not understand in that capacity is sometimes we need those closed spaces within which we can heal one another, within which we don't have to defend the sheer existence of racism or the sheer existence of transphobia to the cis people who would be in the room, right? And so the closing of those spaces is not necessarily to prevent the construction of alliances. It's a space within which education doesn't need to happen and healing can, true community can. And there are separate spaces within which community can happen across identities. So I think allies, if there's one thing that you could do to support QDPOC or people or trans folks in these closed spaces, it's not to be offended by our need for that. It's to respect that and to say that you get to live in a world every day where your space, you are the majority in that space and you are held up and affirmed in that space. And sometimes we need that as well.
Can you speak a little more to how you bring your own personal narrative into the work that you do? I mean, you come through so strongly, and it's because you bring in, you know, stories and personal experience into your published work. Do you bring that into the classroom? Do you bring that into the work that you do with students?
This is a great question. And I think because I have always been so identified so closely and so strongly with the communities that I talked with for research projects, it's been impossible for me to remove myself from those projects. And in fact, the critical approach that my mentors and colleagues take really encourages the inclusion of personal narrative into understanding whatever research project you're doing, because we would say you can never truly take yourself out of that context. And so writing yourself into understanding through your project truly is transformative and can work to break down some of those power imbalances that exist between the researcher and the researched, right? So I'm in community with these folks. They're my friends. They're my community. If I'm revealing things about them, I should also be revealing how this particular site is affecting me, how my story has led me to this space. And I think about that very practically in the classroom as well. I don't have to come out as a person of color, right? It's written on my body. People see that. They read my name. They know this. But my decision to come out as someone who passes as a straight person for many people because of my cisgender femme identity, I always make the decision to come out in the classroom because I feel that I have a commitment to teaching. And I always come out in the classroom because I feel that for students to truly understand people who are multiply marginalized in society as leaders in our society can be revolutionary. And it goes back to that moment when I had my first teacher of color. Potentially, if I weren't to come out in the classroom, I might never make that connection with another queer student or someone who is an ally to the queer and trans community and would have maybe never been able to make that connection with me. So in all senses, I believe that it's important to acknowledge how our personal identities shape our orientation to the space and how we enter it. And to not do that, I feel, is truly irresponsible and really leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah, of course, people are going to make their own calls about their feeling of safety in a particular mm-hmm. context, but mm-hmm. you can see how this extends beyond the classroom. I mean, fighting against narratives of, oh, the personal and professional, mm-hmm. that line has to be really clear in an educational setting. Mm-hmm. But we say that all the time in, you know, nonprofit setting and for-profit, mm-hmm. As well as in academia. And so this idea of how we bring our full selves mm-hmm. to the places where we work and to the relationships that we have in those, you know, quote-unquote professional spaces really is life-changing and can can really impact the people that you're working with and, mm-hmm. and around.
Right. And a lot of times people think about being out in the classroom as being really, as disclosing too much about your personal life. And for me, it's not that at all. It's about, it's being just as proud about, my identity as a straight colleague would be by wearing an engagement ring and talking about their children, right? Like, I make visible my queer identity just as much as I need to be on par with that, right? Just to make visible what is rendered invisible and assumed to be not there. So I share it to the point of rendering it visible, not necessarily or never to cross any personal or professional boundaries, which I think is automatically where people go when they think about teachers, particularly being out in the classroom. Like, all that means is that I want you to see who I am as legitimate as the heterosexual cisgender couple who is married and has a picture, have one another's pictures on their desk at work.
As we begin to wrap up our conversation for tonight, I was just curious if you had any final thoughts for our listeners and also what you're doing these days to find sources of hope or energy.
Absolutely. So I think that now more than ever, the intentional community that I have found with other queer and trans people of color is what sustains me, right? So I belong to an online community that for me, honestly, has been life-changing called Cutie Pot Colorado. It's an online community. I've met folks through social meetup groups. We've done activist things together. And it's as simple as every Tuesday we post a selfie thread, you know, when you feel like the world is beating down on you and it doesn't appreciate or affirm your racial identity or your sexual orientation identity, it's at least helpful to be able to see one another's smiling faces and affirm one another. And so simple things like that, waking up to see the smiling faces of other Cutie Pock folks, honestly, is what keeps me going. And then also going back to what I place at the center of my life, which is alliances across lines of difference, making sure that even though I might not understand what my trans family and friends are experiencing, that we are there to hold space for one another, usually weekly gathering to support one another, making sure that we have time to process the goings on of the world, but also to not and to just be with one another. So I think intentional closed communities can be really helpful and restorative, but then also knowing that the people who love us, even though they might not be able to understand the exact perspective from which we are speaking and living, are there to support us, and that we should do the same for them.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm Sean Kenny, and I've been speaking with Krishna Patisapu. Krishna currently sits on the board of directors for Out Boulder County and works on diversity for the College of Education at CU Boulder. For more information about this episode, go online to our website at news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about tonight's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. Just like the last.